is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, ever cheerful, always here, I am the mouth of the South. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Grillion Report. And I'm glad, of course, as always, just being honest and direct, I'm glad to be able to spend time with you every week. All of you out there. I'm in one of those states of mind today. Flying solo, by the way. Caleb and Tyler will be back with us shortly. It's apparently that busy time of the year where everybody has stuff going on. Everybody has obligations and things that they have to get to and take care of, and therefore, well, I have my obligations to you. And here we are for another week in the weird. Glad to be your host, as always. It is, as of today, Friday, September 20th, 2013, as I'm recording this. Some of you will be hearing this today. Some of you may be hearing it in just a few days. Some of you may not download this until the next time I go live, which will be, well, actually won't be Sunday night. Unfortunately, the live program Sunday night is going to be preempted because, again, of the busyness going on this time of the year leading up to Paradigm Symposium, leading up to all of those fabulous holidays. For most people, that starts around Thanksgiving. For me, it starts around the time of Halloween. That remains one of my very favorite holidays. And I like to celebrate it when I can, and yet usually my busyness prevents me from being able to get as elaborate with my costumes. Long before Robert Downey Jr. ever donned that famous iron suit known as the Iron Man costume, I had always had it in my mind, ever since my early teens, I wanted to make a full-on elaborate Iron Man costume and make this my presentation for Halloween. Walk around, give out, you know, trick-or-treaters their candy and stuff, dressed as Iron Man in this elaborate, you know, with meters, bells, whistles, light-ups, almost kind of more like a steampunk Iron Man, I think is what I envisioned. But anyway, I digress. Halloween, a wonderful, wonderful holiday. That's going to be right after Paradigm Symposium. And then, yes, truly, before you know it, then there's Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year. And before you know it, I'll be headed to Fort Lauderdale to catch a boat ride down into the heart of ancient mysteries on the Ancient Alien Cruise, along with Hugh Newman, David Hetcher Childress, and one of our Paradigm Symposium speakers, Dr. Robert Schock. We've had him on the program here in just the last few weeks. Before we get to news this week, I just want to talk with you for a moment. And I'm in the mood to chat things up, because I believe that when you're podcasting, it's about being real. And even though these programs, the Micah Hanks program and Grillion Report, typically broadcast live, again, I listen to the mainstream media, the news that you hear every day in the mainstream mediums, your Fox News, your MSNBC, your CNN. I think what turns a lot of people off from those kinds of approaches to news, those approaches to media, and again, I think that every medium likes to think that they are the ones that are right. They are the ones that are fair and balanced. They are the ones who are the authorities. They are the ones who are the true leaders in free speech and dissemination of accurate information. Yeah, everybody likes to think about that, but I've spent a lot of time and having worked in medium the media medium myself for the last several years, you do get to a sublime point where all of a sudden you just realize that so much is BS. You realize that everyone has a front that they try and put forward. Even I, when I come on this program, I strive to try and be the realest person that I can be. You know, once there was a person who left a review on our iTunes for the Grillion Report, and the iTunes reviewer referred to me as the most down-to-earth podcaster. I couldn't be more humbled and appreciative of that kind of a statement. And, you know, for good or for ill, I appreciate when people go on iTunes and they leave those reviews and they say, hey, this is what I like or this is what I dislike about the program. At times, negative reviews have helped direct me in a way that I think is more content-driven and less jabber those very same people may be hearing what I'm saying right now and think, okay, we're going to go ahead and fast forward to the interview next hour with Dr. Carl Shuker. It's a first-time appearance he'll be making on the Graylian Report, and we'll be talking about cryptozoologies and his new book, Mirabilis, that was released by Anomalous Books. And that's fine. If heartfelt communication, you know, from a Southern guy like me, isn't your cup of tea, go ahead and fast forward to the beginning of the first hour. We'll be talking about Bigfoot and lake monsters. Enjoy. For the rest of you, this is one of those rare opportunities, you know, that I have just to be able to sit here and talk to you. And it is important to do that because in the name of being real, I have to tell you, later in this hour, we are going to be looking at news like we always do. I'm going to be looking at some stories that are bothering me. Yes, we will be talking about everything from banning, or rather waiving bans on providing terrorists with weapons, to Obamacare, to this Navy Yard shooter, conspiracies, right down to aliens, comets, and altered states of consciousness. It's like, where else in the world are you going to hear a narrative assembled that touches on all of those elements? I'm going to try and do that in the next hour. But before we get to all that news, and before we get to the discussion of cryptozoology that will follow, it is important to point out that while there is news and while there are tragedies, we've heard about a lot of them. Just this morning, there was another shooting in Chicago. We started off this business week, yes, with this Navy Yard massacre, with this guy who walks out there, Aaron Alexis. He's a 34-year-old former Navy reservist who managed to kill 12 people. Yes, this story gets very bizarre. Yes, Alex Jones, within hours, as expected, I might as well just call myself a psychic now, because as expected, Alex Jones was calling this a false flag. Nobody saw that coming, right? Well, there is information that can be gathered and that can be used to put together the pieces of the puzzle, and we can begin to form a certain level of awareness about tragedies such as this Navy Yard shooting, or the inner workings of our political organizations and things, you know, like that in Washington. Right now, I mean, we're talking about literally a 230-189 vote passed by the House this morning for a temporary funding bill to keep the federal government running after September 30th, but also to essentially defund the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. You can begin to look at news, you can begin to look at stories, you can begin to listen to your political authorities, and you can begin to see after a while that, yes, a narrative emerges, and yes, knowledge can be gleaned about how the world really works. And then you can go and you can watch your mainstream news sources, and you can get the spin, the Fabian facade that is put forward as real information. Everyone is entitled to their opinion. Well, almost everybody, because again, you know, if certain lawmakers have that their way, people like me, it's going to become increasingly difficult for people like me to be able to bring information to people. It's going to become increasingly difficult for someone like me, who I've always called myself a writer and a journalist, having worked for years in news, broadcast news and broadcast media, talk radio. I've written, of course, articles on everything from ancient history to news and politics and current events and everything in between for the last several years. And yet, a person who has done this and done it for a living for years, it is getting to a point where people like me, it may be difficult for some of us to continue to call ourselves journalists according to the determinations of some of our lawmakers. And so when I look at people who are feeding you BS on the mainstream news sources, and I look at people who are sitting there and are willing to tell you at times what I truly, in my heart of hearts, believe to be bold-faced lies, and then I look at the way that certain people in positions of power and control would hope to take a, and again, I try my damnedest to offer a rational, again, I use that term heartfelt also, I'll throw that in there as well, a rational, heartfelt perspective on world events, on esoteric subjects, and on things that I feel are of importance or of a need to know to my listenership. And there's the real possibility that at some point there will be limitations based on not only how I can do that and how I can disseminate my views on these subjects, but also on how others will be able to do the same. All your favorite podcasts, all your favorite news blogs, all your favorite commentators, pundits, journalists, bloggers, you know, it will become a very different kind of playing field here in just the next few years if we aren't careful. We're already headed down that road right now. And so part of me wants to fight, you know, to fight to maintain some semblance of that sacred freedom of speech, that First Amendment right to be able to go out there and speak my mind, and by the authority invested in me as a result of sitting myself behind a microphone a couple of times a week and addressing, you know, thousands of people that for whatever reason, whether it be pure entertainment, whether it be a sense of connectedness, whether it be cosmic love, as we've talked about in the past on this program, or anything else, people who tune into the programs that I produce to hear what I have to say, it is something that I not only take great delight in, but I also put a degree of not just seriousness, but also kind of take a sense of responsibility in being able to provide information to people through this podcast, through the radio program, through the sites, you know, through the social networks and everything else. When those things may be in jeopardy, there is a sense within me that wants to fight to protect that. Then there's also a sense that wants to say, you know what, let's make the best of it while we can. And that's not a passive kind of a thing. That's just, to an extent, the reality of the circumstance and the situation. By making myself over the years, it's certainly been a conscious attempt at becoming more apolitical, more agnostic, as middle of the road as I possibly can be. So as to diffuse the BS that comes filtering down from the mainstream and from the overt, in-your-face sources of information that generally feed us what we are supposed to know, what are we expected to believe. You know, by learning to look at everything from a moderate, centrist kind of a standpoint, it's helped me disseminate to my way of thinking an element of truth. No believer or no skeptic who puts themselves in such a polarized position, or no lawmaker or congressman or pundit or mere political supporter who polarizes themselves far right or far left or anything like that, they will never be able to look at the world objectively. And what I've found is that, yes, there are mysteries in this existence. Yes, there are conspiracies. Yes, we are being lied to. But things are almost never as far off on the opposite extreme as the one that we are expected to believe, usually given by any point source. Alex Jones may tell you there are conspiracies, and I think that he is just so far out there sometimes. Sure, there's a grain of truth to what he says, just like there is a grain of truth to what you're going to read in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. There's a truth that can emerge in all instances, but that alone is not the whole truth. And we have to be able to be discerning, and we have to be able to look carefully at what we are told, and we have to be able to think about it, process it, meditate on it. And then we can look at the world around us and we can say, okay, now armed with the proper filter, what's really going on? That is what I try to do with this program. That's what I try and do. And in an effort to do that, lately it has become increasingly apparent to me that you have to be real. You know, I tell you about Paradigm Symposium, for instance, because it is an incredible event, but I also put blood, sweat, tears, personal finances, hours, you know, labor into putting on that event every year. So does Scotty Roberts, Gary Evans, you know, and the other people who are involved in this thing. Yes, of course, obviously, if I'm going to talk about Paradigm Symposium, I want people to buy tickets. Day passes are now available. And we're only a month out from that event. And of course, I've got to tell people, you got to get your day passes. Or if you're going to stay the entire time, save a little money and buy a weekend pass. Whatever you want to do, don't miss the event. I tell you because I want you to be there. I want you to be there, yes, because of course, there is a financial interest. But there is equally that interest that is the center focus, the crux, if you will, of this program and of every other medium that I seek to address the public through. I'm offering you something different. I'm offering, through something like Paradigm Symposium, to what extent I'm involved, my involvement seeks to offer you something different. This program, being almost 150% mine and my endeavor, save only the opinions and the ideas that are put forth by the guests and, of course, the people who participate on the program with me. You know, this is a medium through which I offer you an alternative perspective. I'm not telling you that if your science and history books say one thing, to believe exactly the opposite. I'm saying question everything. But be able to discern that there is a grain of truth to all of it, and that what you choose to do with the truths that you accept, hopefully based on logical processes, hopefully based on informed opinion making, hopefully based on, to an extent, allowing your heart and your mind to work in union to guide you toward those things that are important, those things that matter, those things that are meaningful, and those things that are factual. You know, that is the central focus. And in everything that I do, that is what I try to bring to people. And the only way you can succeed in doing that is being real. And there are times where I get behind this radio microphone and I feel the necessity to become a broadcaster, to be a radio broadcaster. I feel the need, you know, the responsibility to sit here and to read news stories, to fire audio, some of which we're going to do this hour. You know, there's a certain amount of ego, I think, that even goes into doing that. There are other times where I just want to sit down. I don't want to comb my hair. I don't want to shave. I want to be sitting here and drinking coffee like I'm sitting here drinking coffee and talking to you right now. And I want to just be able to say, what's up? You know, how are you? What's going on? I want to be able to talk to you. And I think that that's what makes podcasting and alternative media so important, is because in addition to that alternative idea that I hope to try and express through the various channels available to me, I want to do that, by the way, because I've found these things to be enriching, if not at times somewhat terrifying, but usually that's the minority of cases, but it's meaningful to me, and I want to share things of meaning to me with people like you. But also, I want to be able to talk to you, though. And that's the thing, is that we are different. Podcasters, alternative media outlets, we are different because we don't have to put on a face or a facade in order to tell you what we suppose is true and what we suppose that you need to know. We don't have to be disingenuous. And when I sit down and I talk to you, I can be myself. I don't have to scream. I don't have to get angry. I don't have to be sensational. I don't have to promote an absurd ideology. I don't have to tell you that every time tragedy strikes, whether it be in the nation's capital or in the ghettos or in the suburbs or in the woodlands, I don't have to tell you that every time that happens, it was weather manipulation, false flag attacks, inside jobs, covert operations, COINTELPRO, so that I can sell you something. I don't have to do that, and that's what's beautiful about what we do. I always strive, and this is my commitment to you, the listener, I will always strive to try and be as real as possible. If I fail, I apologize in advance. I don't think anybody's perfect, but sometimes you stumble, sometimes you fall down. You're no good unless you get back up. And right now, I'll tell you that my goal in life and my goal, my commitment to you, is to try and be real in all the things that I do and that I present to you. That said, this is another fantastic edition of the Grayling Report in store for you. When we come back, we will be looking at real news. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay with us.
So, Jacqueline.
Yes, Mom?
I wanted to talk to you about something and... Oh, wait. Hold on. I just got a text.
Oh, wait, Mom. I just got a message. So many comments on my comment.
Hey, guys, check out my new video game.
Mom, what?
Huh?
Pew, pew.
What'd you say?
This weekend, unplug. Getting closer to nature can get you closer to your family. To find the forest nearest you, go to discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Today, you ate Greek yogurt, took the train, you plan to work out, Skipped it.
You did all those things that one normally does the day before a devastating earthquake. You never know when the day before is the day before. Prepare for tomorrow at ready.gov/today. That's ready.gov/today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
From beautiful, sunny land of the sky here in Asheville, North Carolina, I am your mouth of the South, Micah Hanks. Welcome back to the program. It is the Grayligan Report. Always so glad to be able to spend some time with you. If you're sensing a bit of gratitude in my voice this week, well, that's because there is gratitude in my voice. Again, truly, when I say I'm happy to be able to spend time with you, I am. You know, as if I didn't spend enough time on podcasting and all the stuff that I do. You know, there are times where I think, if I had time, if I can make time, I would like to be able to provide more. It's part of this being real thing I'm ranting about a little this week. I love to be able to talk about issues, and it's very important. And something I neglected to mention in the last segment is that there's also a spiritual component to that that I think is worthy of being addressed just as well. That spiritual component is... I'll tell you, actually, let me back up. This is what got me thinking about this. It was funny because a lot of people, of course, would view this as a potentially dangerous thing, but something that we've discussed, I've written about it in my in books like Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule. You know, there is, to me, a fascinating element to our existence that involves the altered state, where we alter consciousness and thus perceive reality differently. There are different ways you can do this. Meditation, focused breathing, ecstatic body postures, yoga, things like that. I think that there's also that ability to influence the mind and the body chemically that is certainly dangerous if done in a purely recreational way and done in an excessive way. You know, contrary to the old maxim of the members of Motley Crue, excess is not always best. But nonetheless, again, with my own research, I've sought to try and examine the parallels between spiritual, religious, mystical experiences described over the ages, and then to also look at the similarities therein that we find to those experiences as described by the psychonauts, if you want to call them that, you know, the users of things like dimethyltryptamine and iboga. And it was iboga specifically that came up in a discussion, a tweet of all things, sent along to Aaron Wright, my buddy with Mysterious Universe, and someone had said, what if during the iboga experience, the guiding voice that you hear was actually Micah Hanks? And I thought, how cool is that? You know, that someone would say, that someone would liken my voice to a spiritual kind of a guiding force. Whether or not you're someone who agrees with the idea of utilization of ecstatic experiences induced using hallucinogens. You know, I personally, and this is what's so strange for a lot of people, although I've written about that, I guess a lot of people assume, and funny enough, a guy actually even confronted me back in February at the UFO Congress and said, you know, I can tell, Micah Hanks, you're one of those people who knows nothing about altered states. I can tell someone who's never used those kinds of things. And he was absolutely right. I am not a person who is a user of psychotropic drugs. And then I was happy to tell him, you're absolutely right. And that's why I wrote a book about it. And he just rolled his eyes. Oh, what do you know about spirituality? Not being a user. You're obviously one of these close-minded skeptic types. Well, certainly I'm skeptical. In the very same sense that Arthur Kessler was skeptical. But Kessler also was a person who was very open-minded, who was scientific in his thinking, and someone who recognized the levels of myth, culture, symbolism, the archetypal substructure within the human mind that is conducive to the altered state. And those are things that I think are absolutely, absolutely, if anything, maybe more than influential, they may be the very root of what we perceive as consciousness and intelligence. They may be the very qualities and quantities that define who and what we are as human beings. So anyway, there's that spiritual component to it as well, and I think that has to be acknowledged just as well, because in the future, there's a part of me that wants to gravitate more toward that. I told the radio host Hillary Ramo one time when she asked me a very spiritual question live on the radio on her program. I told her, I said, it's funny because people don't ask me that very often. You know, people read a book like The Ghost Rockets. This is a very, you know, I'm holding a copy in my hand here. I'm looking at this thinking this is a very technical book. The Ghost Rockets gets into what J. Allen Hynek late in life would have called a very nuts and bolts aspect of UFO research. There is an element of conspiracy to it. I think that there's also a lot of information that you will find that is substantiated by known hard facts, and yet which also expresses an element to the UFO mystery, which remains, while verifiable to an extent by eyewitnesses, by in some cases shrapnel and an actual, you know, the after effects of missile collisions and things like that. But this is also something that is very nuts and bolts and still unexplainable just as well. That's my whole purpose in presenting it, is because, hey, look, if we've got something that is a piece, a small piece of the greater puzzle, but which points to something physical and tangible that we can grab with and grapple with and look at and say, okay, there's something here, that helps us. That helps further what we're able to do. That helps formulate and foster understanding on the whole. And while this book is not going to explain to you the inner workings of the physical dynamics of a flying saucer, it's going to point at something that is a part of the UFO mystery that will make you go, huh, there is something going on here. And that is the best thing that we as researchers can try and do. It's much more difficult to do that with spiritual things. And so when Hillary Ramo asked this question, which had been, what is it, I think she'd ask, what is it that you feel, you know, ties you to the spiritual and that unites you with the spiritual? And I said, it's funny because of my research, especially into UFOs, people typically gravitate toward asking me more nuts and bolts physical questions. That doesn't mean that I don't have a spiritual side. And that doesn't mean that the spiritual, the deeply spiritual component to our existence isn't as much a part of me, despite being a hard rationalist, a person who is very skeptical, a person who really seeks to try and find answers. I don't think that religion and science, for instance, have to exist apart from one another. I think that there is just kind of a polarization ideologically that separates the two. And there's also a bit of a gap where what we perceive as the spiritual or the religious or the mystical and what we perceive as the hard, physical, scientific, they don't meet just yet. One day I think they will. But until they do, people will view them as living apart from one another, being two separate ways of living or thinking. I don't think they have to be two separate ways of living and thinking. I don't think that they have to be separated at all. I think that there is a continuum that connects all things. And when you see that, again, maybe this is, you know, speaking from the moderate center here, you know, the moderate agnostic, I don't know if I'd say uncommitted, because there are certainly things that I'm committed to, but I also don't commit to belief in those stereotypes that gather around the extremities. You begin to see, though, that there is a continuum between all things, and the mystical can exist with the scientific. For Hillary Ramo, I explained it like this. I said, you know, it's like having separate partitions on a hard drive, and you could install Windows 98 on one, you could put Windows, you know, 2013 on another, or what is it now, Windows 7, whatever, Windows 8, you know, Windows 13, wherever the hell we are. I've got it on one of these computers here. That shows how much I worry about those kinds of things. And then I could have, you know, iOS. I could have a Mac operating system on another partition. I think that within the sphere of the human mind, we can operate in much the same way. I've got a logical, rational, scientific side, and then there's a spiritual side that allows the things that science cannot explain, entertains them, and expresses to an extent a wholeness that we are able to share with the universe. And that I'm comfortable with both of those partitions, as I explained in the example. And so, again, despite my ability to be logical, skeptical, but open-minded, there is a spiritual component too. That is something that in an effort to be real, I sincerely hope also is regularly expressed, maybe more so than it has been in the past on this program. Because getting back to our roots, I think that there are things that unite us and there are reasons why people of like mind come together and they would listen to a program like this and they would read books that challenge thought and that defy ideology. There is a reason why people come together in such instances. There's a reason why you are here and why you're listening to me talk right now. That is important to me. More so probably than you realize. And that is why all of these aspects of our human nature have to be explored on a program like the Graylian Report. And speaking of exploration, now we'll get to a little news, because there's a lot of it. We've got just about half an hour to get through all of it before we begin our discussion with Dr. Carl Schuker on cryptozoology. But, you know, I think despite the fact that this is not paranormal, the news stories that I'm about to present to you today are going to paint an interesting narrative for you, I think. I think we're going to begin to see something novel as it emerges. The first one, Washington Examiner carried this story. Obama waives ban on arming terrorists to allow aid to Syrian opposition. Now, this is interesting. It's also fairly transparent. I guess that when we voted for President Barack Obama, we all assumed that, those of us who did vote, bear with me in the analogy, we all assumed that President Barack Obama was going to lead with what he campaigned on, which was transparency. Maybe we're finally seeing a little here. Because he's waived a provision of federal law designed to prevent the supply of arms to terrorist groups in what is obviously being perceived as an effort to ensure his ability to provide military assistance to opposition groups in Syria who are fighting against dictator Bashar Assad. Now, here's what's important about this. Rather than viewing this peripherally as a humanitarian effort to fight an evil dictator who has utilized chemical weapons against his people, against those who oppose him, we have to take into consideration that there is a bit of a conflict of interest here. Because the Syrian opposition are associated not only with radical Islamic terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda. Okay. But we're also looking at a situation where I think to the liking of the American people and many people internationally, we do not have hard evidence that Assad was behind the chemical attack, which we would potentially seek to provide support to opposition in response to. Now, what's interesting about all this is, of course, yes, we know that Putin's played checkmate. Barack Obama is now in a position, along with John Kerry and the rest of the administration, where we're having to wait and see if a unilateral disarmament of chemical weapons will work. Some are concerned that Bashar Assad is actually going to utilize this time to move chemical weapons to different parts of Syria where they may be more difficult to obtain. They could fall into the hands of terrorists. This was an initial concern at the outset was, of course, that there may have already been chemical weapons that were obtained by rebel forces and that they were actually the ones that had used these and that the fingers being pointed at Assad instead. There's a lot of trouble that we look at here. Assad's regime is backed by Iran and Hezbollah, of course, who have sworn to attack the United States if we attack, not Iran, but Hezbollah has sworn to attack, and the Iranian contingents within these groups. They've sworn to attack the U.S. if we go into Syria. We've said that for the time being, we won't go into Syria, but with this provision of federal law being waived, and these are specifically prohibitions in sections 40 and 40A of the Arms Control Export Act, what this essentially does is this allows us to send weaponry to countries where terrorist enemies of the United States may reside, where they may exist. And in this case, obviously, by helping the opposition to Assad, we would be directly aiding Al-Qaeda. At this juncture, I think that it's appropriate to share something with you. This is something that has not aired, I don't believe, on this program yet, and I call it the Obama Syria Zombie March. We're going to hear what he has said recently about Syria. We're going to back up and we're going to go back to 2007, 2008 and look at what he was saying around that time. and we're going to compare the two to the tune of a little zombie music here.
I will not put American boots on the ground in Syria. I will not pursue an open-ended action like Iraq or Afghanistan. I will not pursue a prolonged air campaign like Libya or Kosovo. This will be a targeted strike to achieve a clear objective. Deterring the use of chemical weapons and degrading Assad's capabilities.
I will give our military a new mission on my first day in office. Ending this war. We will keep a residual force to perform specific missions targeting any remnants of al-Qaeda, protecting our service members and diplomats. And yes, we will make tactical adjustments as we implement this strategy. That is what any responsible commander-in-chief must do.
He says. Point out again that little part about remnant portions of al-Qaeda, targeting them. Now, of course, he was talking about doing this in Afghanistan, so I guess that's why it doesn't apply if we go directly into Syria, and I'm not convinced at the present that this won't still happen. Is that the justification? Since we're not talking about Afghanistan, we're not talking about Iraq, we're not talking about where we've already been, if we go someplace else, it's okay for us to help the terrorists, the bad guys, the very ones that back just a few years ago I said that we would continue to try and stop. It's pretty troubling. Changing gears now. This is the breaking news this morning. As of Friday, September 20th, 2013, the House has passed a spending bill to defund Obamacare. House Republicans passed their stopgap funding bill Friday to keep government open while terminating the new health care law, setting up a final showdown, as it's being called, next week with Senate Democrats and President Obama, who have firmly rejected that. Now, the 230 to 189 vote, which split almost exclusively along party lines, is the precursor to the big action next week, when the Senate is expected to strip out the health care provisions and send the bill back to the House, where Republicans will have to decide whether they will indeed accept it at that point. As expected, there is a lot of discussion about the pros and the cons and a lot of political posturing in relation to this. I think first we've got audio sound bites from Kathy Rogers, who spoke shortly after the vote this morning.
Today, the House has acted to keep the government open, to control spending, and to protect people from an unworkable law that is making it harder on them. My colleagues have all voted in favor of this law because it's going to help moms and dads and families and young people and seniors all across this country. And that's who this is all about. When I was home in August, like so many of my colleagues, I heard the stories from individuals and families who are concerned, who are panicked over the implementation of this law and the impact that it's having on their lives. So that's why the House has acted.
I'm sorry, do you notice that chiming sound, that buzzing noise in the background? It's like, is somebody trying to tell her that her time's already up? Anyway, I think you've heard enough. Now, she, of course, is talking about how this will help families, how this will help children. And the reason that's being said is because on the other extreme, Kathy Rogers, of course, is we've got this in our notes here someplace. I believe she is a Washington Republican representative. Nancy Pelosi, speaking yesterday, called this a wolf in wolf's clothing and shared, of course, a very divergent viewpoint on the Republican provisions that would apparently and effectively take down Obamacare.
Tomorrow, the Republicans will hold their Tea Party continuing resolution. That Tea Party resolution is to shut down government, to double down on the Republican requester that will cost us a million jobs.
Requester?
This is a job killer by the end of 2014, and that's a conservative estimate. It could be 1.6 million jobs, and gut investments in education and research to put American companies... what's really interesting.
I noticed the about shift there. You know, what's really interesting
about it is it's a wolf in wolf's clothing. It's a terrible appropriations bill, the CR, but it is also a bill that puts insurance companies back in charge of medical decisions for America's families. This is a resolution that devastates health care in other ways, other than just defunding the Affordable Care Act. And related to that, it effectively eliminates the strongly bipartisan children's health insurance program. You may recall that when that passed in the Senate in a bipartisan way, it was a veto-proof majority. with a 70% cut in the CHIP program. It wreaks havoc by disrupting provider payments on Medicare, and it also, again, the Children's Health Program, and cuts billions of dollars. Billions of dollars.
Is it just me, or does she sound a little disjointed there? I see the point that she's trying to make, but again, you know, the presentation, Nancy's always been a little strange the way that she goes about these things. Nonetheless, though, notice that her key issue that she has is, of course, the portions of the resolution that would effectively make it more difficult for provisions that had previously been passed almost, as she'd referred to it, veto-proof for children's care. Now, yet again, we see the far-right wingers are being called the negativists, the selfish, the evil, and she points this all out because this is effectively going to potentially hand insurance back to private providers, which, interestingly enough, is still the case largely with Obamacare. I think there are a lot of people out there who still think that Obamacare is going to be free health care. I'm not convinced that in the long run that's not the intention, but right now it's really more of kind of a corporatist situation where it will only ensure that providers, again, independent insurance providers and companies, it ensures them business because people are mandated to have to be able to have health care, in which case they have to go buy it or it has to be provided by businesses. Now, the downside, of course, and this is one of the points that people on the right have been making, not just people on the right, there have been plenty on the left just as well, and I should just in fairness point that out. The other thing that people have been pointing out here is that in addition to the fact that there's a mandate that is ensuring business to certain companies, by the same token, on smaller businesses and sometimes larger businesses just as well. We've seen this actually in the news here in my home state of North Carolina. Certain organizations, entities, companies are having to back down. They're having to point out that they are not going to be able to provide through the requirements of the Affordable Care Act. In other words, in order to be able to maintain their business and a certain number of employees and to be able to provide insurance as required under the Act for all of those employees, a big problem arises, which typically, kind of like with minimum wage, would require fewer employees. We'd have to shave off and cut our losses in order to be able to provide the insurance that is required. The reason I compare that with minimum wage is, again, because think about it like this. You've got four or five employees, and all of a sudden you're required to have to pay them $1 or $2 more per hour, and you only make, with your business, so many dollars per day. That doesn't mean that you have to start, well, you could start charging more, but that also could affect your sales. You've got two things you can do. You can try and offset the losses by charging more, find other ways to draw more revenue, or you can shave off a couple of employees and pay the existing ones a little bit more. But it's also going to make it more difficult for certain businesses to maintain the stringent requirements that the Affordable Care Act requires. And so this is both bad, especially for smaller businesses, but some larger corporate chains just as well. And it's also a situation that in the long run may make it difficult for those independent companies, these insurance providers, to maintain their business just as well, which is another argument that's been brought to the table that the long-term effect could be that it will force the United States into a position where we are providing free government health care. But again, people say, well, who, and I remember this was brought up by a colleague of mine years ago when this was first being brought to the forefront at the very beginning of Obama's presidency. What idiot would argue against free health care? Yes, there are people out there who in lesser income families or in other positions where they encounter economic problems, economic challenges. There are people who may need government assistance, and we have programs like Medicaid and Medicare that are designed to provide that kind of assistance in addition to charities and things like that. But the problem with free healthcare is that, I'm sorry, folks, there is no such thing as free. There's always going to be a tab. There's always going to be a price tab on that. You can expect it in tax increases or in a variety of other ways. And so the long-term effects, again, I think, very well could be aimed at getting private insurance out of the equation altogether and having to force a single-payer system. But what is the byproduct of that? Probably higher taxes. Folks, you're not going to get anything for free. Now, again, let's step back into the middle and let's look at the other side again. We've heard from, Kathy Rogers, Nancy Pelosi. The final word goes to our favorite guy, John Boehner. Let's see if he sounds as drunk as Pelosi did this morning.
The president said, if we pass this law, health care costs will go down. Well, now we find out that health care costs are going up for most Americans. Listen, this is hurting our constituents. It's hurting the American people. At a time when the economy is barely eking along, wages aren't increasing, new jobs aren't available, and what are we doing? We're putting more cost and more inconvenience on the American people. It's time for us to say no. It's time to stop this before it causes any more damage to American families and American businesses. You got businesses all over the country who are not hiring because of the impact of this law. You've got other businesses that are reducing the hours for their employees because of this law. And so our message to the United States Senate is real simple.
Did you hear it? Our message to the United States.
The American people don't want the government shut down, and they don't want Obamacare.
Okay, I did detect just a little bit of slurred speech right there toward the end. I don't know. It's difficult, really. He did make a lot of the same points that I made right there. And yet, by the same token, again, if you listen to that entire speech, this is the federal spending and health care law. It was a Republican rally that took place this morning after the vote. This was around 8:35 a.m. Pacific time. There was an undeniable element of political posturing that was going on there. What I would love to see is people step back off of the we're just going to take jabs at the other side and make our argument, make our case look like it's good, and both sides basically try and say that it's all about the children. I wish we could all just speak frankly about this and say, look, you know, we're really all probably trying to pass this bill, Obamacare, that is. We're all really trying to get this into effect because the long-term effect is it's going to grant more control to government. Call that a conspiracy if you want, but let's just wait a few weeks. Let's just wait a few weeks and just see where this actually goes. I'll be interested to see if what we saw in Washington this morning, this 230 to 189 vote, I'm going to be interested in seeing how much this actually goes, or how much of this actually goes toward defunding the Affordable Care Act. Let's just see what happens. If you have thoughts that you'd like to share, info@graylianreport.com. Would love to hear from you just as well. And now, again, moving on, the big story this week, and because of a scheduling conflict on Tuesday, we were not able to go live with this week's edition of the Graylian Report, but this is the big story this week out of Washington, this former Navy reservist who killed 12 people at the Washington Navy Yard. Now, I recognize that by Friday morning, as I'm talking to you now, very little is going to be offered in this discourse and in this discussion here present that you haven't read about and that you haven't heard elsewhere. There is an awful lot of speculation. I was a little disgusted that within hours, you got to keep in mind, I think by around 9 a.m., or we'll say at least, 9:45 Eastern time, this was being reported. There were already people who were posturing, and there were people who were going to the Twitter and going to their Facebooks, and there were people who were, already arguing about gun control before the actual shooting incident had been contained. Before Aaron Alexis, before his name had actually even been released publicly, before any of this information had even come out, there were people who were already arguing about gun control. Okay, let's just give people the benefit of the doubt and roll that up to 10 o'clock a.m. Well, by noon, 1 o'clock, when the Rush Limbaughs and the Alex Joneses and people are taking to the airwaves, Alex, again, as I'd already mentioned, Alex Jones was already going out there and doing exactly what you knew he was going to do. He's sitting there saying that this is a false flag. I don't think at that point we knew this guy's name. There was an incredible, to me, a parallel, and this should be pointed out, between the Newtown, Connecticut shooting and this one, in the sense that this guy had apparently, Aaron Alexis had apparently had a identification card that belonged to another guy, some fellow in Virginia, and police go and they stake out at his house and the guy shows up. I think he ended up being smacked on the hand for driving on a revoked license, but it was pretty apparent that this was not the shooter and that they had a suspect who had been killed at the site of the shooting. But there had been stories, and again, it's always like this. The media scrambles to try and get information out. In a way, I'm almost glad that we're talking about this a few days after the fact, because we've had a little time for it to settle, a little time for more information to come out. There's been a lot of speculation, but the dust is settling, so to speak, and now we can kind of look at this and go, okay, what was really happening? What we know in hindsight is that the media at the outset was reporting that there was possibly another shooter, maybe as many as three shooters. We also know that Aaron Alexis had had the opportunity to go into buildings where he could have been granted easy access, but he'd apparently used an identification card to gain access to the Navy Yard, that he had gone to the third floor and he'd begun shooting people. And interestingly, this guy had apparently had a record that involved at least two gun-related incidents for which no charges were brought against him in the past. That's a mystery in itself, how this guy could, I think in the first instance, shoot through the roof of his apartment and potentially endanger the lives of the woman living upstairs. When he was confronted about this, of course, by law enforcement, he had said that he had been cleaning his gun and it had accidentally discharged while it was being cleaned. Any idiot who would be cleaning a loaded handgun shouldn't be allowed to have that gun anyway. I have a good friend who, as a matter of fact, still to this day has a bullet lodged in his leg because of the mishandling of a firearm in that very same fashion. But even then, the guy was sitting down and the barrel was pointed downward. Who would be cleaning a handgun loaded, pointed upward? That's even stranger. Somehow, some way, law enforcement bought the story. No charges were brought against him, although the woman who lived upstairs had said that Alexis had claimed, or rather had complained, about how noisy she was at times. A second incident involved him allegedly blacking out in anger and shooting out the tires of a vehicle. Again, no charges were brought against him. I think he was arrested in that case. So you have to look at all this and think, what the hell was going on here that this guy had been involved in two gun-related crimes? And I'm not saying take his gun away, take his privileges away. I'm saying this guy, at very least, should have had charges brought against him at the very base. And even that hadn't been, in neither instance, that hadn't been the case. Now, just as of today, there have been a lot of new elements that are coming out. For instance, I think we've seen that Representative Jeff Miller of Florida, chairman of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, has asked about the medications that Alexis may have been on. He had said, quote, "One of the medications that Alexis received does have a side effect that could, in fact, have been a problem. However, that doesn't mean that it was, and that's why we're asking the VA for a little more information as to what they had prescribed Aaron Alexis. What were the drug interactions? What were the side effects of the drugs that were prescribed by the VA? We do still have some questions that we're asking," he had said. Now, that's interesting because we're seeing that Aaron Alexis had first apparently been on prescription drugs. And then he had also, according to his former employer, and as far as I know, I think that this is fairly new information just as well, a representative from his former employer had actually called the hotel where he had been staying and had been saying that he is unstable and that the company, that is the company that had employed him, was bringing him home. Okay, this is apparently being revealed via daily logs that the hotel he'd been staying in had kept, because throughout a course of successive evenings leading up to the shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington, Aaron Alexis had apparently knocked on doors of people and woken people up. He frightened one person so badly that she asked to be moved. And so the employer had called, and the quote was that Brenda from Experts Inc. had called about Mr. Alexis in room 407, according to the daily logs there at the hotel where he'd been staying, a residence inn in nearby Middleton. And she said, in the log, it notes that an employee had, on August 7th, stated that this Brenda from Experts Inc. had explained that Aaron Alexis is unstable. Apparently they were aware of it, and that the company had planned to bring him home. She asked me to check the room, but it was vacant, so we could not check him out. Apparently he'd left already at that point. Now, the reason he'd gone knocking on rooms, and this is the other big story, most of us are aware of this by now, Aaron Alexis had been saying that he was hearing voices. Aaron Alexis had also been going around and telling people that he was being blasted by some kind of a microwave device. He referred to it as a microwave machine, and that this microwave machine was causing him to hear voices. He had described there being, I believe, two male individuals and a female that had been following him around using this microwave machine to keep him from sleeping. It was causing him to hear voices and all other kinds of strange things. The guy was flipping out. And by the same token, we're also seeing that this individual, this is interesting because he had apparently used a valid pass to gain access to the secured Navy Yard installation on Monday. U.S. law enforcement officials had also told AP reporters that there was no known connection to terrorism. There was no manifesto, nothing else like that. But that this guy, again, had been treated by Veterans Affairs. And despite all this, despite what his employers had said, the Navy, okay, and he had formerly been, he'd spent time as a member of the Navy Reserve, the Navy had not declared him mentally unfit. It's incredibly strange. The entire thing is incredibly strange. And, you know, on the quote-unquote side of the lunatic fringe, there have also been some interesting parallels that have come up to previous shootings. I'd already mentioned the Newtown, Connecticut connection where there was, although he'd used a valid card, there was apparently another individual's identification on him, much like Adam Lanza, back around the first of the year, had carried an identification card for his brother. And this had led the mainstream media initially to report the identity of a different shooter. This is the same sort of thing that happened here. I don't know if he was inspired by that. Again, the guy was absolutely flipping out, but obviously seemed to be well enough aware of his of his facilities and capable of carrying out a fairly complex crime where he apparently had managed to gain access to this secure location. And he'd gone in there and he'd been shooting people up. Managed to kill 12 people before he was taken down in gunfire. You know, again, the whole thing's so strange. And so, to an extent, I think that there are legitimate, odd aspects to this. Now, coming out a few days after the fact, five to be exact, well, four since Monday, I think it's easier to say, okay, we have some strange things here. We have some odd elements. Does that prove that this was an inside job, that this guy was being... You know, his mind was being controlled by a microwave machine and all this junk, or is it literally just the paranoid ramblings of a deeply disturbed individual who sought to take the lives of others? I would opt toward the latter, but nonetheless, there are strange elements, and they can be expressed, they can be discussed, and we can acknowledge that there are some really odd things about this case. But in the hours, again, the hours following the shooting, was it a bit much maybe for people like Alex Jones to go out there and say, oh, you know, false flag? Saw that coming. I wonder, because this morning, again, there's a story out of Chicago saying that 13 people, apparently on a basketball court, were shot when at least one gunman walked up and started firing with a high-powered gun. Some have said it looked like an AK. The actual quote here was, I think it was like an AK, according to one neighbor who described the shooting. Man, it was a lot of shots. Boom, 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 boom. A little boy got hit in the face. And this is the terrible thing is that, yes, apparently there was a 3-year-old boy who was one of the 13 people who was shot. I haven't listened to Alex Jones' program today. I wonder if he'll say that this was a false flag, that this was an inside job, that this was a secret government agent that went out there and just decided to shoot somebody. The point is that these don't have to be inside jobs for political entities to try and steer these tragic incidents toward a gun control debate, where in truth, I wonder if that is as important as discussing the mental health issues involved. Those that were obviously underlying, for instance, the Aaron Alexis shooting earlier this week. I don't think we have to say that this was an inside job, that it was MK Ultra, that there was mind control, microwave machines, hidden entities, voice control, Manchurian candidates, any of that sort of stuff, to say this was a mentally disturbed person. He took the lives of people in a surprisingly well-carried-out attack, I would say. And this will inevitably, and already has been, steered toward the gun control debate. I think that this one is much more a mental health issue. I think Adam Lanza, as terrible as that was also mostly a mental health issue. I think the majority of these, for someone to take a gun and want to go and shoot people, is a mental health issue. Why are we not talking about that? And we've got the one congressman who's asking, okay, what did the VA actually prescribe to this guy? These are issues that need to be addressed. These are important issues. I'll leave you with this. Radio host Clyde Lewis, had brought a very interesting element to this on his radio program Tuesday night. It was what he described as a cryptic poem that had allegedly been posted on a Facebook page, purported to have belonged to Aaron Alexis. At this point, I don't know if that has been proven or not. But this is the poem which seems to make allusions to Heaven's Gate. It goes as follows. It's looking down from the heavens above. The clock stands still as does the earth. We made a sign, a signal, and were heard. The 11th hour is near on the 17th day of the 12th month. They are coming. Ancient sailors of space and time, a code to be remembered in history and rhyme, all shall be revealed in an almighty flash, and so shall the drums of the Sitting Bull hash. So come, stand ready, they are coming, but be steady, be taken to the second place, our little gray saving grace. Now my body lies dead and on fire, I did it all for you, my sire. Remember March 24th, 25th, and 26th in the year of 1997. The away team left and went to heaven. Another world they saw. They live in awe, but they will return to save us all. And thus, my story of fame and glory, my testimony is my word and all I have. For today, I joined the away team. Now, we don't know if that is indeed something that has been directly connected with Aaron Alexis. If any of our listenership in the coming days is able to find any information about that, that would be interesting. I would be interested in hearing more about that. Doing a search online, I wasn't able to find a whole lot myself. But that is interesting. That is certainly interesting. And it may be a tenuous or a non-connection. Again, this was a point that radio host Clyde Lewis had pointed out Tuesday night on his program Ground Zero. I found that interesting. And in the midst of this mental health debate, you know, I mean, I don't think this thing could get any weirder, but if this is indeed, and I'm not promoting it as definitively connected with the shooter, the presumed shooter, Aaron Alexis, but if it were to be found to be something that he had written, it does seem to make allusions to Heaven's Gate, and of course also to the comet ISON, which is supposed to be arriving later this year. Very strange indeed. To wrap up this hour, and I think to maybe set the stage for things to come, did you hear that a new species of legless lizard was found in, of all places? You know, when you hear about a new species, not just one, actually, there were four found. But let me tell you this. These four species of legless lizards, you'd think that they'd be found maybe in a jungle, in a desert, someplace like that. These were found in a remote lot near LAX. That's right, in Southern California. They were discovered in a highly insignificant vacant lot towards the end of a Los Angeles International Airport runway by two researchers. Four new species of legless lizards. Folks, I want you to take into consideration something here for just a moment. When in a vacant lot on an empty runway at LAX, you can find creatures as yet unknown to science, maybe we should reopen the debate about other kinds of unidentified creatures that could exist elsewhere around the world. And that's what we'll be discussing during the next hour with Dr. Carl Shuker and his new book, Mirabilis. We're going to be looking at cryptozoology here on the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this. Busy summer, huh? And it's only going to get busier. Thanksgiving's already right around the corner, and before you know it, we'll all be singing jingle bells. Don't you deserve a break? Well, this year, why not make it a winter vacation and join the Ancient Alien Cruise as it sets sail from Fort Lauderdale on January 9th, 2014. Kick things off with a private cocktail reception followed by lectures by some of the finest researchers in the field. Author and publisher David Hatcher Childress will be there, as well as Megalithomania's Hugh Newman, geologist and author Robert Schock, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, host of the Micah Hanks program on KGRA Radio. But you don't just have to sit and listen. This cruise will present a one-of-a-kind opportunity to meet your hosts, discuss mysteries of the ancient past, dine with the speakers aboard one of the ship's fine restaurants, and even engage in land excursions to ancient sites. Broaden your horizons while taking a little time off and enjoy watching the sunset over the high seas. Visit ancientaliencruise.com or call 1-877-642-4308 and reserve your cabin today before time runs out. Visit ancientaliencruise.com.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by: never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind. Ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
Is the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Thank you, Dick Oakley, and welcome to the second hour of this week's edition of the Graylian Report. It is a special edition. I think they're always special, but this one is a discussion that will be, no doubt, very near and dear to my heart. We're about to discuss The Miracles and Marvels of Mirabilis, which is a new book subtitled A Carnival of Cryptozoology and Unnatural History by none other than Dr. Carl P. N. Shuker. He's never been a guest on this program before, but I've followed his work for a very long time. And Carl's latest book, released by Anomalous Books, takes a look, a rather unconventional zoological approach, if you will, to the study of creatures that may exist but are as yet unproven to modern science. Now, time and time again in our history, we have studied biological life forms on this planet. We thought that we have successfully documented every variety of life that could exist on terra firma. And then we hear stories of trolls and demons and monsters that live in those foothills of the savannah, or perhaps in the deepest jungles of the Amazon, or perhaps in the deepest, darkest depths of the ocean. And then we end up finding that something like a mountain gorilla, or something like a giant squid, believed at one time to be the mere stuff of myth and legend, actually exists, and that there are actual instances where there are creatures long held to be literally the stuff of fantasy that come to pass as being actual, real, living creatures, and that those legends that had focused on the supposed existence were based on actual, factual, first-hand accounts and witness experiences. These people weren't delusional. They weren't liars. They weren't making anything up. They had had actual, real experiences with flesh-and-blood creatures. Tonight, I hope to discuss a number of these with Dr. Carl Shuker. But first, I got my start years and years ago doing cryptozoology research, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, sea monsters, things like this, the Yeti. And of course, Ivan Sanderson's seminal work, Abominable Snowman, Legend Come to Life, was one of those highly influential books that was given me. Literally, I was only about 5 years old when I first read that. And it's not the kind of thing that most five-year-olds read, and it certainly left an impression on me. And therefore, it's with great pleasure that today we have a very special guest on the program. He's a gentleman whose work I've followed for a very long time, Dr. Carl Shuker. And his new book is called Mirabilis. This book is fascinating. It's been released by Anomalous Books. And it is described as a carnival unlike anything that you have ever read about, visited, or ever even imagined before. It is indeed probably going to be one of the best-known cryptozoological tomes in recent years. And so, again, with due excitement, I welcome to the program for the first time Dr. Carl Shuker. How are you, Carl?
Hello, I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, absolutely. Let's start at the beginning. I know that you've been doing this for an awful long time. What led you to take interest in zoology, and specifically the potential that there might be creatures that exist out there as yet unknown to science?
Well, I think from the earliest of ages, I was always fascinated with animals. My mother always told me that as a very young child, anything with an animal always attracted my attention, whether it be a toy or a program on television or a bird flying through the sky. If it was animal related, I was there, I was attracted. It was no use buying me a toy if it wasn't an animal, I wouldn't take any notice. Everything, any book, any toy, whatever, always had to be animal related. So she said, you know, from an early age, it was obvious that I was going to have some sort of a career with animals. And I did, I became a zoologist. But again, my mother was a very, very influential person in my life in so many ways, but also in cryptozoology, because when I was 12 or 13, as a birthday present, one of the birthday presents for that year, she bought me a copy of the classic cryptozoology book, On the Track of Unknown Animals, by Dr. Bernard Heuvelmans. And I was just absolutely astounded. I mean, I'd read about things like Bigfoot and the Yeti and the Loch Ness Monster and sea serpents, but this book opened an entire panorama of creatures I'd never heard of: the Nandi Bear, the Spotted Lion, the Orang Pendek, the Queensland Tiger, all sorts of extraordinary creatures that may or may not exist. I was just totally hooked. I mean, that book probably holds the record for the number of times I've read any book. I literally have read that book dozens and dozens of times and could virtually quote entire chunks from it. And from then on, you know, I became a zoologist and I did zoological research and I obtained a PhD in zoology, but I always knew cryptozoology, that is what I wanted to do with my life in some way, some capacity. And after obtaining the PhD, I decided to take a bold step and move away from mainstream zoological research and go into writing as an independent freelance writer and zoological consultant specializing in cryptozoology. And the first book that I wrote, Mystery Cats of the World, came out in 1989 and proved successful. I mean, we didn't know what to expect. Would it be a complete flop? Would it do well? And it did very well, and it was very heartening. And so it inspired me to do a second book and a third and a fourth, and I achieved, you know, the success that I wanted to do. I became an independent cryptozoological researcher, one of the few full-time cryptozoologists in the world. And now Mirabilis is out, book number 19, and I've hundreds of articles out, and I've consulted or contributed to about another 10 volumes. So there's literally about 30 books of mine and lots of articles. So it's become a lifelong career from that one book that Mom bought me all those years ago.
It's, you know, it literally puts a smile on my face to hear that, because there are not very many in this field, first of all, who would pursue the degree in academia, who would pursue the PhD and go through the official channels, if you would, and then who would come to this and say, okay, now that I have credibility, I'm going to put everything at stake and I'm going to go against the grain with the mainstream and then manage to succeed with it. More power to you. That's what's so wonderful about this. And I love to see that someone with academic background takes these subjects so seriously. Carl, I noticed that often people who begin with an interest in, for instance, UFOs or strange creatures, zoological mysteries, ancient mysteries, they may begin at the outset with an interest in those things, and then after they do pursue the academic career, they change their opinions and they begin to become more skeptical. I think skepticism is good, but maybe we shouldn't throw out all the babies with the bathwater. You didn't. What is it about certain aspects of cryptozoology, the testimonies, the stories, what is it that kept you interested over the years?
Well, running alongside the idea that there could be major unknown animals still awaiting discovery, I'd always been very fascinated by the certainty that in recent years, within the last 100 years, a lot of major new animals had indeed been discovered. You know, there were precedents, in other words. Mountain gorilla, okapi, the famous cedar camphor prehistoric fish that turned up alive and well in the 1930s. There were lots and lots of these animals, and they all follow the same pattern. The local people in whatever area of the world, Africa, North America, South America, Australia, Asia, had reported seeing these creatures. Zoologists didn't know of them and initially assumed that they were just mythological creatures of local folklore. But then usually an explorer or someone or a local person with a particular passion for this creature went out and actually looked for it and eventually obtained physical evidence, usually a body or a skin or a skull, something that could be physically assessed, physically examined, and sure enough, it turned out to be a hitherto unknown species, which could then be categorised, classified, given a formal scientific name, and therefore introduced into the official pantheon of creatures that we know to exist. And if all of this can happen, and it still happens today, over and over, then surely, you know, the idea of there being unknown animals out there is not fantasy. It's already happening. It's happening every day. And the third book that I actually did wrote in 1993, and, well, actually, I actually wrote it over about 5 years. It took quite a long time to research, but it was published in 1993, and it was called The Lost Ark, New and Rediscovered Animals in the 20th Century. And it's the first book ever published anywhere in the world to concentrate not on the aspect of animals dying out, becoming extinct, but on the totally converse, hitherto unnoticed aspect, that we're actually discovering new animals and rediscovering ones that we thought were long extinct. And that did very well. That achieved success worldwide because it was the first of its kind, and it opened a lot of people's eyes, including a lot of mainstream zoologists, because there had been a tradition, oh, we've discovered all the main creatures, there's nothing much, you know, little insects and whatever in the rainforest, fine, yeah, no problem with that, but they're not going to be any big animals left. And this book showed them, well, yes, there are, but all through the last century, big animals have been discovered and are still being discovered today. So why do we suddenly have to stop and say, no, there are no more? You know, there are plenty of reports of cryptozoological creatures that may exist. Not all of them will. Some of them will be folklore, but some won't. Some will be real animals, and the fun is trying to determine which are which. And so I think that is what really promoted my interest and made me, despite having the academic qualifications and whatever, made me look at these stories with a much more open-minded approach, because there are precedents, and when you have as many precedents, the Lost Ark is full of about 500 precedents, when you have that many, you have to look at these creatures in a much more objective, but at the same time, open-minded, not closed-minded manner, and that's what I did.
Absolutely. You know, something that you bring up, by the way, is that often there will be creatures that may have been discovered or acknowledged but not fully accepted that later are proven to exist. And that reminds me of something that you used toward the end of your book, a quote by Albert Szent-Györgyi, who says, discovery consists in seeing what everyone else has been seeing and thinking and what no one else has thought. I love that quote. Something else you bring up, of course, is the possibility that we might begin with insects. Most people in the mainstream would say, well, there may be insects as yet undiscovered. Now, in the book's fourth chapter, you do talk about, or rather, it's not actually an insect, it's an arachnid, but you talk about the potential for very large spiders that may exist. Let's begin in the arachnid realm and work our way up from there. This is going to be a very large discovery if it's a large spider. What is the possibility? Are there giant spiders out there?
Well, like a lot of people, we think of giant spiders as the staple of sci-fi horror films, the enormous creatures appearing out of the jungle or whatever and attacking people. But when you start to look into a lot of reports worldwide, and we're not talking about one area, you realise that there have actually been bona fide, serious reports of creatures just like that, very large spiders, far, far bigger than anything that we know to science. In New Guinea, for example, there have been various reports of a spider the size of a small puppy seen in spider webs by soldiers who were fighting in World War II in the jungles of Papua New Guinea particularly. And then the one that has probably attracted most attention is in the Congo, and it's a creature called the Jabar Fofi, if I pronounce that correctly. The local people call it by that name. And there was a report back in 1938 of two people driving along the path through the jungle, and what appeared to be a large monkey or even an elderly, hunched, elderly old man hobbling across the road in front of them. But as they got nearer, they realised, to their horror, that this was no elderly man hobbling across the road. This was a spider, but spider the size of an old man or of a very large monkey, and it scuttled away into the undergrowth and was not seen again. And they reported this to a field cryptozoologist called Bill Gibbons, and Bill and had been to the Congo and to various other tropical African places looking for the alleged living dinosaur Motilium Bembe. But he's also gathered reports of other creatures, and he was fascinated by the Jabar Fofi, and he's collected a lot of reports, and apparently this creature is still being seen today. The local people say it's endangered. There are nowhere near as many of them as there used to be, but that it is absolutely, genuinely true. There is no question about it. They even could tell them that it lays eggs the size of peanuts, which are white, and that the spiderlings that hatch from them are yellow, and later turn brown as they get older, and they can attack and eat creatures as large and very small antelopes known as doikas. Now, I mean, that is a totally frightening thought. But again, creatures like that are also being reported from South America, and TV programs have even sent experts out to look for them. And although as yet they haven't actually seen one of the giant ones, they have captured some very large spiders, larger than they expected to find. In these areas of South America, and even North America, it seems you think, well, okay, we must know more about North America than South America, but there have even been giant spiders reported in North America, and one appeared out of some people were going to church one evening in Louisiana, and a spider, which they memorably described as the size of a wash tub, emerged from a ditch just ahead of them on the path that they were going, and again crossed the road in front of them and into the undergrowth the other side. And needless to say, from that day on, they chose a different way to go to church. They decided not to use that route in future, take a different one. The big problem with this is you'd love, in one sense, unless you're an arachnophobe, you'd love to believe in these creatures, but physiologically, the problem with the spider is that, it, rather like the insect, it has a very limited size because of its respiratory system. Its respiratory system does not allow it to grow too large. Most spiders respire by what are called book lungs, and these book lungs can only get to a certain size before they get too big for the efficiency of them to be good enough for the creature to respire. But you have to look at the possibility, if there is a spider as large as that, could it have evolved an advanced, different form of respiration? It doesn't have to stick to one form. There is an old, well, not an old, but there is a saying from Jurassic Park, which I love, life will find a way.
Dr. Ian Malcolm.
And, you know, it's very true of zoology in general. Perhaps the physiology of the spider has found a way and has found a different, fundamentally different way of respiring that will allow these creatures to grow larger. I mean, it's pure speculation. I'm certainly not saying that such a system exists, but it could explain, if such a system could evolve, well, then it could certainly explain larger spiders than those that we know at present.
Absolutely. You know, it's a reasonable point, I think, because we often think that we understand everything, and then we come along a creature, you know, like the okapi, or we come along a certain kind of an eel, or we come along a variety of deep sea fish that behaves or has evolved to exist in a way that is completely counterlogical to everything that we have known to exist and observed, and yet which nonetheless has found a way to exist. Life does indeed...
I was just going to say, a great example of that is the thermal vent systems at the bottom of the sea. I mean, until the 1970s, we thought the bottom of the sea was icy cold, no life forms there whatsoever. And then the submarine Alvin, the research submarine, was sent to the bottom of the sea, and to everyone's astonishment, they found that the vents, the holes at the bottom of the sea, were thermal hot water was being pumped up, heated by the magma beneath the ocean surface. And there's a huge ecosystem around these vents consisting of creatures that no one had ever seen before. Not one of these creatures had ever been reported before by science. And you were talking creatures like giant tube-dwelling worms, 8 to 10 feet long, with huge brilliant red tentacles that look like kind of alien flowers growing at the bottom of the sea, bizarre jellyfish that look like giant dandelion clocks. There were enormous long spaghetti-like worms stretched across the bottom of the sea. There were white crabs that were completely blind. There were giant clams a foot long with bright red internal organs. All of this totally new. Not one of these species had ever been reported before by science. So you've got an entire ecosystem, not just a creature, an entire ecosystem unknown to science, thriving probably for millions of years on the seabed that no one knew anything about.
And there they were, yet. When we get down to
a point... And the unique thing, which was really, really astonishing, unique to any life form on Earth, they weren't obtaining their energy from the sun.
Right.
Because being so far down, there was no sunlight. They were obtaining their energy from chemical reactions produced by bacteria on the sea bottom, chemosynthetic and energy reactions, something that had never been known before. So every other form of creature on Earth ultimately derives its energy from the sun, but not these creatures. These were as alien in one sense as if that we discovered them in outer space.
Absolutely, which makes me think, Dr. Carl, that when we go looking for alien life, we shouldn't necessarily hold to the conventions of what we would expect of Earth life, because obviously even Earth life can, I think extremophilia might be the terminology for it, extremophiles yep. being these varieties of organisms that can learn to or, adapt to live in absolutely extreme conditions. Maybe other kinds of life elsewhere in the universe has done the same thing. We're talking with Dr. Carl Schuker. His new book is Mirabilis, A Carnival of Cryptozoology and Unnatural History. It's released by Anomalous Books. We'll have that linked to the website for those who would like to learn a little bit more about it. But in the meantime, we have to go to a break. When we come back, we'll pick up this discussion of all things cryptozoological with Dr. Carl Schuker. It's his first time here on the Graylian Report. Very glad to have him. I'm sure it won't be his last. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. Stay with us, and we'll be back right after this.
At risk of losing your home in a foreclosure? We can help. We'll deal with your bank, lower your principal. We'll buy you a pony, give you the ability to fly. We'll let you ride a unicorn. We'll give you a...
If you're facing foreclosure, who should you trust? The HOPE Hotline is a free resource connecting you with HUD-approved housing counseling agencies available 24 hours a day who can give you the information and clarity you need. Call the HOPE Hotline at 888-995-HOPE. That's 888-995-4673. Brought to you by NeighborWorks America and the Ad Council.
Hi, folks. Micah here with your Paradigm Symposium ticket update, now available. Day passes. That's right. Day passes for the one and only Paradigm Symposium 2013. It's a one-of-a-kind event. You don't want to miss it. That's going to be in historic St. Paul, Minnesota at the Union Depot this October 17th through the 20th. Again, day passes are now available. Just visit ParadigmSymposium.com for details. Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. Talking tonight with Dr. Carl Schuker, Ph.D. He is, by trade, a zoologist, and by declaration, a cryptozoologist. Not all the anomalous is merely pseudoscience, and Dr. Carl is here to discuss the scientific aspects of study of as-yet unexplained, unknown, and unrevealed to academia creatures. Those that we may actually call cryptids, I think, and I don't think that that's an improper usage of the term here, because even in academic discussion, we have to take into consideration animals that remain hidden. The very terminology itself, cryptozoology, the study of hidden animals. Now, picking up, I want to change gears a bit here. There's a lot of mention on your blog, which I'd like to mention in itself, by the way. It's called Schuker Nature. You can find it at www.carlschuker, that's K-A-R-L-S-H-U-K-E-R. Just remember, Carl Schuker with two Ks. It's carlschuker.blogspot.com. Schuker Nature is the name of the blog. Just this morning, I noticed that there was a brilliant article put up, and there are several others that deal with giant snakes. This one seminal photograph that I think a lot of people probably don't know about was taken in 1959 in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. A Belgian military pilot named Colonel Remy van Lier, had taken this photograph, and it literally shows what is purported to be a giant snake rearing up at the helicopter. Tell us about this, and tell us about the possibility of there being other varieties of large snakes in the Congo.
Well, the as you said, the pilot, the Belgian pilot called Remy van Lier, was flying over what appeared to be some very large termite hills or ant hills, and suddenly this snake appeared. And the pilot, I've actually seen a recorded interview with him. I think he's passed away now, but this was several years ago, and I can still hear his voice, telling us what happened. And he said this snake just appeared out of the ground, and he just reared up as if it was literally as if it wanted to attack him and pull the helicopter down. It just reared up, only momentarily, because, of course, a snake can't literally stand on its tail. It can only just lunge up and then will obviously fall back. But it did that, and the colonel was shocked beyond all measure and whizzed away with all speed. But he was able, he got a camera, a rare thing in cryptozoology, he got not only got a camera to hand, but he actually had the foresight to use it, and he took a snap. I don't know whether he took more than one, but he took at least one snap of the snake, and it came out well. And that is the famous, the kind of iconic, it's one of the iconic images of cryptozoology, of this huge, or what appears, that's the all-important thing, what appears to be this huge snake rearing up out of the ground. And the big argument ever since has been, how big was that snake? And what people have tried to do is analyse it by looking at the scale of the ant hill, the termite hill, the topographical features in the photograph. And a lot of different ideas have come forward. But the popular one is that it was around 45 feet long, and that is the kind of popular, some people have said larger, some have said smaller, but the kind of average is about 45, and that is bigger than any known specimen of snake ever recorded in modern times. As to what type of snake it is, it's in the area of the geographical area of the rock python. The rock python is a very large snake. It's not known certainly to get to 45 feet, but it is known to get up to probably around 20 feet or so in extreme cases. And the area of the Congo where this took place is a kind of semi-autonomous area called Katanga, not the most well-explored area by any means. And it's just possible that in these more remote places, some extra large specimens might exist. It's not unbelievable that you will get extreme sized creatures, particularly in areas where they're not going to be hunted. In areas where you're going to get a lot of hunting, obviously the first creatures to go are all the top end of the scale sized animals, because those are the trophy animals. So a lot of animals back 100 years, 200 years, had larger specimens, because in those days they were still safe. But when the white hunting took place and the early safaris before conservation came along, that was what people went out for, to get trophies and to kill all the biggest specimens. So those are what you would lose. But in areas like Katanga, you could still have extra large specimens and they would still be around. So could it be a kind of gargantuan rock python? You can't rule it out. Physiologically, we know creatures like that can exist, because there was a creature many, many millions of years ago called Titanoboa, and Titanoboa was absolutely vast. I mean, you are talking over 40 feet with that, and that is known from incomplete at the moment, incomplete remains, but there's enough of it to be able to extrapolate what the full size of the creature was, and it would have been totally colossal. So if a creature like that could exist, and we know that he could, we can't totally rule out that an extra-large python existed in Katanga. And, of course, the other big creature, the big serpent that everyone thinks of, is the giant anaconda in South America, which, of course, is where Titanoboa used to be. And the great thing is with the anaconda is it's amphibious. It lives in water. So you've got an animal that is actually buoyed by the water. And so that could really grow to a size, because it hasn't got to be on land and to support its own weight. You've got problems with the lungs. Could the lungs sustain the body weight of the creature on land? If it's a creature living in water, the water sustains the weight. So you really could get large anacondas, no question whatsoever. It is possible, and some of the swamplands and the vast areas are, even today with all the deforestation, there are still so many vast areas of swampland and marshland and rivers and tributaries in South America. But I think that an absolutely stupendous giant anaconda, or the Sucuriju gigante as it's called, is not impossible by any means. And there have been all sorts of reports, 70 feet long, 80 feet long, all sorts of reports of giant anacondas. So that, I think, is definitely one of the more probable occurrences of a giant snake around the world. go to South America.
Similar to the argument that could be made about relic hominids, Bigfoot, creatures like that, is that when we look at the fossil record, similar creatures have existed. Ancient man's ancestors, whether it be the Neanderthal or whether we look at, of course, a favorite of mine, Heidelberg man, which had gone through in South America a period of, gigantism where 7 foot and maybe more was kind of the norm. We see that there were creatures that were very similar to what a Sasquatch might look like today, much the same in the fossil record of North Africa. As you've pointed out on your blog, there's Gigantophis, I believe it's Garstini is how it's pronounced.
Yep.
It's, a relic fossil snake, but of course that had been, this was 40 million years ago, but the thing had been in excess of 10 meters in length. So we know that at times in Earth's history, there were incredibly large, large reptiles of all varieties, but of course there were snakes too. So it doesn't seem to rule out the possibility that that could exist. Those creatures have existed in the past. You know, speaking of relic hominids, what is your take on the reports that Sanderson began to gather and, of course, which you've proliferated in the modern day with regard to creatures like Bigfoot, the Alma, Yeti, Yeren in China? What are these creatures, the Orang Pendek? Do they exist? Are they folk memories? What is the case with these hominids?
I think probably... they are probably all of those things. I don't think that there's certainly not just one identity to explain all of them. If they all exist, I think we're probably looking at several different species. There are reports of all of them. The big question is determining which, if any, are based upon real animals and which are based on pure folklore. Because, I mean, we have to take into account that the human imagination is an absolutely miraculous device. That when you look at unicorns and centaurs and minotaurs and man-eating birds and Stymphalian birds and all these incredible, totally mythological creatures that fire-breathing dragons that have been invented, you cannot rule out that any animal that's being reported cryptozoologically, you cannot rule out the possibility this is purely fabulous, it is a purely mythological creature. But the trick is determining which of those really are mythological and which of them have some sort of kernel of truth in them that are based on real creatures. Perhaps the descriptions are distorted. Eyewitnesses do have a tendency, mostly subconscious, to see aspects that aren't there. The brain kind of fills in the details. You see something briefly, and depending on what you're expecting to see, the brain will it will frequently fill in the details. It will make the eye see what it thinks they should be seeing. So you have to take that into account as well. But out of all of them, I mean, my particular favourite with the man-beast, the crypto-primates, relic hominids, call them what you will, is the Orang Pendek. Mm. Because the Orang Pendek is one of those creatures that has been explored in great detail. It's homeland on the island of Sumatra in Indonesia. The Orang Pendek, the name means short man, and it's reported as about 3 to 4 feet tall, bipedal, hairy, very, very elusive, but the principle, good at climbing trees, but the most important thing is it habitually walks on its back legs. It's not quadrupedal. And there is even the possibility there are two different Orang Pendeks. There's one that could be a large ape, and there's another that could be a primitive human, that there might be two unknown animals that have been collectively combined with one another, confused with one another. But what's so interesting with that is you've got quite a bit of evidence. There are footprints that don't match those of any known species, and there are several cast footprints that have been taken. There are hair samples that have been obtained that do not match the hair samples of any known species. Vocalizations that don't match those of any known species, and so on. There is quite a lot of hard evidence building up with this. And over the last few years, there have been a fair few expeditions, mostly privately financed, that have gone out and are collecting more and more evidence, bit by bit. And I think if I had to be asked what is the most likely major unknown animal to be discovered in the next decade, I'd say the Orang Pendek, because I really do think we've got some hope with that. And of course, what has also given it a great deal of credibility was the recent discovery on a smaller nearby island of Flores, the famous Flores Man, which is from a few thousand years ago, remains of a diminutive species of human, a kind of pygmified, pygmy human, but there was a lot of argument to begin with. Was it just a stunted normal human, or was it a genuine diminutive species in its own right? And the evidence now seems to be leaning in favour of the diminutive valid species in its own right. And on the island of Flores as well, there are even reports that suggest that this creature might still exist, that there might even be modern-day descendants, because there's a small, very orang pendek-like creature being reported from Flores called the Ebugogu. And the Ebugogu and the orang pendek sound so similar, they could be one and the same species. So perhaps orang pendek is an unknown Sumatran version of Flores man. Again, it's all very speculative, but there are a lot of, it's like a jigsaw, but there are a lot of separate pieces, and bit by bit, they're starting to be pieced together, and you're starting to get a picture of what is happening there. Bigfoot, of course, is a different matter, because Sumatra is a large island, but it's certainly not the size of North America. You know, you've got the Pacific Northwest, for example. People say, oh, you know, North America is well known. If Bigfoot was there, we'd have found it long ago. I say to them, if you've ever flown over the forested area of the Pacific Northwest, you wouldn't say that, because it is absolutely vast. I think you could probably have an entire civilization hidden away there, and no one would ever see it. People think that it's got to be a tropical rainforest to hide any unknown species. But believe me, you know, the Pacific Northwest might be temperate, but the area is so immense. And as someone said to me quite recently, if a creature like Bigfoot does exist, it does so without us having discovered it, because it is extremely intelligent and because it is extremely good at keeping itself to itself. It knows us. It knows that we're there. But it's very, very good at keeping itself hidden. And when you're looking for a creature of that nature, you are really posing a problem for yourself in the hope of ever finding it. I mean, there's an old saying, what is the world's most cunning animal? And the answer is that which no man has ever seen. And I think we're probably getting fairly close to that level with Bigfoot. I think it probably is possibly the most intelligent, if it does exist, it's possibly the most intelligent unknown animal on the planet.
You know, Carl, I've wondered, honestly, in terms of development of the brain from one hominid species to another, I wonder sometimes if Bigfoot exists, really how different it is, both physiologically and also in terms of its mental development and its intelligence levels. I wonder how different it actually might be from humans. And regardless, we would have to be dealing with something that is so unlike other animals. I mean, typical wild animals are wary, but when you pair with that wariness, you know, adaptive abilities to survive and intelligence that allows them to conceal themselves, and that they not only can conceal themselves instantaneously through things like camouflage, you know, or hiding, you know, in brush and thickets and things, but I mean, they know to stay far enough away and have adapted to live far away enough from civilization that they never ever present themselves except for those random, nighttime backroad encounters that we hear about, the likes of which the late Dr. Grover Krantz had hoped to have. You know, we're dealing with a creature that is unlike any other animal known to exist, and one with a level of intelligence that I'm not convinced would not be on par with humans. It very well may be that we're dealing with something that is far more human than animal.
It's quite, that is very possible, it's very likely. And also, you have to take one other thing into account. In a sense, we have, by becoming civilized, we've kind of domesticated ourselves. We've changed our way of thinking, and we're ignoring a lot of our primeval brain, the part of our brain that deals with instinct, with survival. A lot of that has been kind of shunted to one side. We don't need that. I mean, obviously we need just a little awareness, but we don't need, I mean, we're not walking out and expecting, you know, a saber-toothed cat to jump on us or anything like that in the middle of New York or whatever. And so that aspect of our brain has been turned off to a great extent. But with Bigfoot, that would be one of the most vital, one of the most essential parts of its brain. So even if it had a similar brain to us, it would be using different parts of it in different ways, and coupled with the level of intelligence, if, as you say, it has a level of intelligence comparable to ours, you are looking at a creature that is equal but very different to us, and can out-compete us in the world, you know, to a level that's beyond comprehension, that our levels of instinct, our levels of awareness in the world wouldn't even begin to come close to Bigfoot at all. And, you know, if it does exist, this is why, as you say, we only see it very randomly, very occasionally. Because it's just too good. That is its world. It knows how to survive in that world, just as we know how to survive in ours. But put us into its world, and you know, you haven't got a chance. You haven't got a chance of expecting to come upon one, to catch one out by surprise or anything like that. That is just not going to happen, except in some absolutely freak. Perhaps you encountered an elderly one or one that was ill or something like that, that was in a very poor state of health. That's possibly, or perhaps even caught in a trap or something, or poisoned or something. That's probably about the only way, or perhaps the other way is to find one that had very, very recently died, before decomposition had set in, before scavenging animals had appeared to take the flesh off the bones and whatever, before the leaf litter and the falling leaves had covered the remains. You know, if you could just be there at that moment. But it really is looking for a needle in a haystack.
Yes, it's a very complex issue, and of course this has bolstered the argument of the skeptics over the years, who have said, you know, we've never found a body, we've never found any, you know, evidence that is absolutely irrefutable, whereas I think to the contrary, much like UFO phenomenon, the UFO phenomenon being something that comes and goes as it pleases and leaves very little trace evidence of the physical variety, Bigfoot is very much the same, and I think that we have to rely to an extent on what may not be hard, undeniable proof, but what nonetheless presents some pretty darn good evidence, and that is the witness testimony. And there have been, I mean, literally sworn affidavits that have been presented over the years by people who could not reconcile in their own minds with what they saw, but which wanted to make it a matter of public record that, hey, there is something very much like us. It's out there, and it exists. We're talking with Dr. Carl Shuker. His new book is Mirabilis, and this is a fantastic book that looks into a wide range of cryptozoological ideas and elements that really aren't discussed in the other literature. When we get back, I want to talk with him a little bit more about how sea serpents fit into this, because there are some remarkable accounts of sea serpents that are included in this book. Again, our guest is Dr. Carl Shuker. This is the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and we'll be right back. Busy summer, huh? And it's only going to get busier. Thanksgiving's already right around the corner, and before you know it, we'll all be singing Jingle Bells. Don't you deserve a break? Well, this year, why not make it a winter vacation and join the Ancient Alien Cruise as it sets sail from Fort Lauderdale on January 9th, 2014. Kick things off with a private cocktail reception, followed by lectures by some of the finest researchers in the field. Author and publisher David Hatcher Childress will be there, as well as Megalithomania's Hugh Newman, geologist and author Robert Schock, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, host of the Micah Hanks program on KGRA Radio. But you don't just have to sit and listen. This cruise will present a one-of-a-kind opportunity to meet your hosts, discuss mysteries of the ancient past, dine with the speakers aboard one of the ship's fine restaurants, and even engage in land excursions to ancient sites. Broaden your horizons while taking a little time off and enjoy watching the sunset over the high seas. Visit AncientAlienCruise.com or call 1-877-642-4308 and reserve your cabin today before time runs out. Visit AncientAlienCruise.com. The land of the sky, this is the Grayling Report, and I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Tonight we're searching the land, the seas, and the air for cryptozoological monstrosities. Our guest, Dr. Carl Shuker, he's the author of the new book, Mirabilis, which probes the mysteries of unexplained, as yet unidentified, animals that may exist in the remote corners of our planet. Now, where we left off, we were talking... Gosh, we've actually run the gamut almost already. We've discussed relic hominids. We've talked a good bit about mystery snakes of gigantic proportions. And along those same lines, I kind of want to take this in the direction here in a moment of following sea serpent reports. I've always been fascinated with sea serpent reports. Creatures of the high seas, the sea serpents, the monsters, the giant crocodiles, giant eels, and other whatsits and whatnots. Carl, what is the likelihood in your mind that there are gigantic beasts that are as yet unknown, perhaps reptilian sea serpents in the literal sense, that exist?
I think with this subject, you have to take a step back and think to yourself, take all the aspects into account, and how probable is it? Well, this particular question deals with creatures in the ocean, and the oceans of the world are vast beyond all conception. And although we have liners and boats and all sorts of other vessels crisscrossing them daily, we have no idea if we're honest. What is in the depths of the sea? As I mentioned earlier on the program, we only found the thermal vent systems in the 70s, and they've been there for millions of years, and we had no idea they even existed. And that is a completely unique ecosystem, and these vents are found in the ocean bottom all over the world now. We now know that. So if that can exist all over the world, a few large species of creature is by no means impossible. New whales are being discovered quite regularly. I mean, you know, several large whales have been discovered in the last few decades. As far as the reptilian creatures are concerned, reptilian sea serpents, on the surface of it, it sounds unlikely. But then again, you have to take into account various eyewitness reports that have been released over the years by people for whom, and I always think this is important, it applies with Bigfoot, it applies with the Loch Ness Monster, it applies with a lot of people and a lot of subjects, that there is no good reason why they should expose themselves to possible ridicule and mockery by saying they've seen these things if they haven't. A lot of people have suffered a great deal by reporting creatures that the official body, as it were, mainstream zoology, doesn't recognize. And as I say, they've come in for all sorts of criticism and whatever for that. But it makes me more willing to believe them, because I think you didn't have to report it. You even if you saw such a creature, you could have kept it to yourself. You didn't have to report it. You knew what was going to happen. So why expose yourself to that level of criticism? There has to be something there. And this has happened with quite a few of these supposed reptilian sea creatures. In New Zealand, for example, I mean, people have gone fishing and they've seen what they've described as a huge crocodile-like sea creature with flippers instead of claws. And all the crocodiles that we know to exist in the world today have normal feet, have normal claws, normal limbs. But millions of years ago, there were sea crocodiles that had true flippers. They even had a fin on their tail, and totally adapted for a sea-dwelling existence. The fossil evidence suggests that those creatures died out, but the eyewitness reports are making people say, well, perhaps they didn't, because a lot of these creatures are still being reported today, and not just from New Zealand. They're being reported from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and occasionally, a great example are ones where they've been actually able to look down through the water and see the creature in its in its full form, to see exactly what it looks like, and it's quite amazing. I mean, just give an example. There was the Sacramento was a ship that was again in the mid-Atlantic, traveling from New York to Australia, and several of the people, the crew on board this ship, saw a creature resting on the surface near to it. And they said it was very alligator-like in appearance, long jaws and so forth, but they could also see the limbs, which you often can't with a sea creature. They usually submerge, but they could see them. And they were flippers. They weren't claws. They were actual flippers. But the creature was 50 to 60 feet long in estimation, and this was seen by the captain. I mean, your captain of a ship is usually pretty good at estimating size, and he said 50 to 60 feet. Now, that is far bigger than any known crocodile or alligator that we know today. And there was a ship going through Brazil, through the waters of Brazil, and they saw a creature that they actually described as frolicking. They were travelling from New York to Brazil at the beginning of the previous century. And again, crocodile-shaped head and huge, I mean, you know, absolutely huge creature, just frolicking almost in a playful manner at the surface of the water, and they watched it for some time, and then it was just twisting around horizontally in circles, and then just it dived beneath the waters. But something like that isn't supposed to exist. So, you know, we there are these creatures that are being reported and cannot be readily explained at all. And when, as in cases like those, you're talking about multiple eyewitnesses, you're not just talking one person, you're talking several people all saw the same thing at the same time and describe it in the same way. You have to take some notice. You can't just, it's not going to be mass hallucination or something. You know, those people saw something and the description is consistent from one person to another. So you have to take some notice of what they're saying.
You know, when we go back to the 1760s, Maastricht, it was actually a Dutch city. There was a limestone quarry there, and among some of the first fossil evidence of dinosaur-type creatures was a creature known today by paleontologists as the mosasaur. This was a creature, as you know, Carl, and some of our listeners may be familiar with. It was very much like what you've described, reptilian, alligator-type head, a whale-like tail, and then flippers. In other words, it was a large reptile that had adapted to living in the oceans. And this is one theory put forward as to what these creatures might actually be. Again, we have evidence from the fossil record that something just like that existed at one time on planet Earth. Now, folks want to say it couldn't be anymore. It couldn't still be out there, and yet those reports persist. And not just these giant crocodilian things. I've often wondered about very large eels as well, because are you familiar, for instance, with the reports of giant leptocephalus, the eel larvae that turn up from time to time?
That's right, yeah. That is quite a controversial subject. The giant eel larva, in one of my books on newly discovered animals, I mention this. And the controversy is still not complete. This giant larva, several feet long, was obtained by a Danish research vessel several decades ago when they were dredging the ocean and for specimens, and they brought it up. And now normally, you know, leptocephaly, the baby eels, at most a few inches long. This one was about 6 feet. Mm. Now, there is a kind of general way of extrapolating based on the size of the larva, the size of the likely adult. And extrapolating up, the idea was that if the larva grew to the size of an adult that known eel larvae grow, in terms of proportion, you could be looking at an adult giant leptocephalus specimen of about 180 feet, which seemed utterly, you know, preposterous. 180 foot long eel, you just can't have these kind of things. And then many years later, some of these giant leptocephali were actually preserved and they were examined. The problem was they were started, the condition of them wasn't brilliant, but they were examined by other scientists and they thought, I think that a mistake has been made here. These aren't what we call true eels. These are what we call spiny eels, notochamphids, and their proportion of elongation developing from the larva to the adult isn't the same ratio. So the giant version of the giant adult version of whatever these larvae, whatever species these larvae belong to, won't be 180 feet. It'll be much smaller. And so for a long time, the concept of the giant eel was thrown out. But now they've been looked at again in recent years, these same specimens, even more degraded now, unfortunately, but they have been looked at. And now we're not so sure that they actually were notochaetes. They could be something else. So therefore, the speculation has begun again as to whether the unknown adult form of these larvae really could be huge. The mystery has gone almost full circle, so we're not at all sure. What we do know, and we certainly know that, is that giant eels or creatures resembling giant eels have been reported on many occasions from various seas around the world, and that if a giant eel did exist, it would fit and would definitely explain certain sightings that at the moment can't be explained by any known species of creature. So that is definitely a possibility. And there's no reason, a giant eel, I can't see that that would kind of disturb any basic ecological principle. I don't see any reason why a giant eel could not exist in terms of its ecological niche. It's just, and physiologically, once again, it's a sea creature, it's a water creature. The size of it would be buoyed by its watery domain, so there's no problem with it growing to that length in terms of it being able to be supported by the water. It's only, again, in terms of its actual physiology. But obviously, until we can obtain more specimens, particularly of the larvae, we can't be absolutely sure. But we can't rule that out. I think a giant eel is by far one of the more plausible possible identities of the, you know, the sea serpent. I mean, that's another thing we talk about, the sea serpent. There's obviously more than one species involved because the eyewitness reports are so diverse, they couldn't all be of one and the same animal. Dr. Heuvelmans came up with a categorization of sea serpents that ran to about 10 different types. Not all those are now believed in because, you know, despite him being an excellent researcher, he did make a few mistakes based on paleontological evidence that existed at the time, but which we now know to be null and void. And so some of his postulated categories of sea serpents were basically based on misinterpretations of paleontological evidence. So some of those have to be ruled out, but not all of them. Some of them still could well be valid, and the giant eel is one of those. There's no reason why a giant eel, in terms of, as I say, the principles that we know, couldn't exist.
Yeah, again, it's something to me that's fascinating because I look at it as being a creature that not only, as you'd pointed out, with the buoyancy factor, especially with salt water, this creature would be able to be large and carry itself. If we look at, for instance, the behavior of a lot of eels, they tend to be very reclusive. They'll live close to the base of the ocean, often in caves and things like that, and yet they will also be known to return to the surface at the time of mating and breeding. So there are a lot of factors that come into question with regard to classic reports of sea serpents, and then the behavior of known existent species of eels, and then, of course, those large leptocephalus specimens. And even if it were a spiny leptocephalus, as you'd said, and there was a different proportion, a six-foot-long infant or a larval stage would have to yield a fairly large parent, even if it wasn't 180 feet, which would be longer than a blue whale.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me, again, because there seems to be a very plausible story going on there that in zoological terms is nothing that could not exist. Maybe we just have not yet proven. Carl, we're almost up on the end of the interview. It's been great talking with you, and I want to just to wrap things up here. You can kind of see where my favorite elements lie. I'm fascinated with the relic hominids. I'm fascinated with the idea of large eels or sea serpents and things like that. What is your favorite area of research in all of this? I know that you must love all of it, but if you had to pick one thing about cryptozoological research that really makes your day, what is it?
Well, I think discovering the answer to perhaps a long-standing mystery is always very satisfactory, and I was able to do that, and I was delighted to be able to do that. And it's actually in the book Mirabilis, and that's a creature a lot of people have heard of called Trunco, which was very briefly, Trunco was reported as a huge white-furred sea monster that was seen off the coast of South Africa attacking or being attacked by two whales, and the battle went on in the early 1920s. The battle went on for hours and was watched by people on the shore, But Trunka apparently lost the battle, and its dead carcass was washed ashore. And it was there for some days. It was taken out by the sea, was re-washed ashore, there for a few days, taken back out again, and never seen again. Now, as far as anyone knew, there were no photos ever taken of it, no samples were ever taken of it. So for about 80 years, there's a huge mystery. Is what on earth was Trunka? It got its name because it was supposed to have a very long elephant-like trunk. And what on earth could this creature be? It doesn't fit any known creature from the fossil record, from the modern day. And 2010... a friend of mine sent me a photo that he'd seen on a website of what was amazingly, supposedly, a photo of Trunka when it had been beached. Now, this was quite sensational, but more so because when I had a look at it, I thought, oh, it'll be a hoax. But when I had a look at it, I realised I actually knew what that creature was. And it was what we call a globster. And a globster is the remains of a whale. The skeleton and the skull have sunk to the bottom of the sea, left behind a sack of... connective tissue known as collagen and blubber, like a kind of huge balloon full of this stuff, and occasionally a rib or something like that projecting out from it. And this looked exactly like a globsterized whale. And then a few days later, we started looking up this. We got the name of the photographer, and we started really investigating this. And lo and behold, there was a magazine called Wide World Magazine. And back in the 1920s, so this meant for 80-odd years, no cryptozoologist had ever noticed this. But in the 1920s, there was an article in Wide World Magazine by the photographer who'd actually been on the shore when the carcass had been washed up in the 1920s, had taken photos and had given the full detailed first-hand eyewitness account of the creature. And there were we found the report, there were the photos. We were the first people in over 80 years to look at the photos and know what we were looking at, and there's no doubt it was a globster. So Trunka, after 80 years, we finally knew what it was. It wasn't a living, hairy, long-trunked creature. What it was a globster, a dead whale. And why it seemed alive, whales have a habit of playing with their prey, tossing it in the water backwards and forwards. And what we suspect was happening, this globsterized whale had been found by two living whales. They've been playing with it far out to sea, throwing it backwards and forwards. The people on the shore had seen it and thought a battle was going on. The white hairiness of Trunka was the connective tissue, the decaying connective tissue of the dead whale. The long trunk was probably a rib that had been embedded within the blubber and the globsterized remains, and the whole, you know, decomposed, stinking body had been washed ashore. That everyone said that the eyewitness said that he'd absolutely stank to high heaven the remains. And this is what people have seen. It had been washed out backwards and forwards a couple of times, then washed away. It had probably literally fallen apart, probably. And in fact, it was noticeable the second time it came ashore, it was a lot smaller than it was the first time, which suggests that parts of it had already started to fall away in the ocean. And so that's what, you know, absolutely everything fits the description. There's no doubt Trunka was not some exotic, hairy, polar bear-like marine elephant. It was just a highly decomposed whale with all the characteristics identification features there. But until photos could actually be looked at, no one could be sure. And these photos had been in an article for over 80 years, published, available to the world to see, and no one had recognized them for what they were.
And there it is, the mystery solved after so many decades. Carl, it has been absolutely fantastic talking with you. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Carl Schuker, you can visit his website, www.carlschuker, that's two Ks, .blogspot.com. I believe you've also got carlschuker.com as well, right?
That's right, yeah. The carlschuker.com is the actual website. carlschuker.blogspot.com is the Schuker Nature with Schuker Nature blog, which is over 300 articles and reports of mystery animals of all kinds. So, yeah.
Yes, Schuker Nature, I have to say, is quite exhaustive. And so if you'd like to learn more about his research, the first thing that I have to recommend to you is to purchase Mirabilis, the latest book by Dr. Carl Schuker, released by Anomalous Books. We'll have that linked in the show notes along with this portion of the program. Carl, what's next for you? What do we expect from you next?
Well, the next book on the conveyor belt, as it were, is a book on dragons. Many years ago, I wrote and it was published, a book on dragons, which concentrated mainly on the mythology, retelling of some of the wonderful dragon myths of the world. But I'd always been interested in a lot more about dragons than just the myths. I was interested in the zoology of dragons. How did dragons come about? Where did we get the idea for dragons? Why are they so infiltrating, even today, in every aspect of our culture. Why are we so fascinated with dragons? They're in every aspect of literature, films, TV, clothing, ornaments, you name it, dreams, heraldry, psychology, every even tattoos, feng shui, you name it, dragons are there somewhere along the line. Why are we so fascinated with them? And so I've done basically, I've written an entire book on every aspect of dragons that you can possibly ever think of, and I've called it Dragons in Zoology, Cryptozoology and Culture, and that hopefully, all being well, should be out by the end of the year, hopefully just in time for Christmas. So that's book number 20.
Well, then for number 20, let's celebrate by having you back on the program, because, you know, during the course of this conversation, we haven't even gotten around to Mushusu or the Sirush, you know, of the Ishtar Gate. I'm fascinated with those legends of dragons, and it sounds like you're going to be the man for the job. So, Carl, in the future, I will look forward to having you back as our guest on the Graylian Report. Thanks again for joining us this time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that will have to do it for another edition of the program. Always glad to have the likes of Carl Schuker and, of course, the likes of you joining us on this program. Just keep in mind, you can always listen in for double your weekly dose of the Mouth of the South by tuning in Sundays at 8 p.m. Eastern, only on KGRARadio.com. You can also stream the Micah Hanks program from MicahHanks.com, in addition to getting news and updates throughout the week, all kinds of stuff out there for you. My gosh, it is a labor of love, and we love you so much that we have to give you as much as we possibly can. You know, before it's all said and done, I'll probably be finding ways to get even more good content out there to folks. But in the meantime, I have to mention yet again, I hope to see you in Minneapolis next month. We're exactly 1 month out from Paradigm Symposium. Day passes are now available at ParadigmSymposium.com. And if you thought about going, I do want to put it out to you that this may be your last opportunity to get tickets. They've really been selling quickly. And if you want to ensure your ability to attend and join, meet me, meet Scotty Roberts, and hang out with the fine cast of speakers that we've got. Robert Schock, Dr. Robert Bavall, Scott Walter of American Unearthed, and so many others. You've got to go to ParadigmSymposium.com right now. Don't wait to get those tickets. Day Pass is now available just as well. That's going to be your Paradigm Symposium update for the moment and your weekly Graylian Report. On behalf of all of us, Matthew Oakley, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the ever-loving Mouth of the South, we bid you adieu, my friends, and until next time, stay strange. We'll talk to you again soon, friends.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.